Time now is 6 o'clock. Keep it right here for City Visions. Good evening.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. As protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd continue this weekend, and as much of the nation grapples with the systemic racism that contributed to his and other deaths of African Americans, we'll talk this hour with Oakland-based racial equality consultant Dr. Lori Watson about how we can start identifying the personal and institutional biases that stand in the way of an equal society. And at the end of the hour, we'll chat with Bay Area musician and educator Eugene Rodriguez. He's the founder of the Mexican cultural organization Los Cenzotles, which has been finding creative ways to amplify the voices of young local musicians during the pandemic. And at the end of the hour, we'll chat with, but first we have an update on the COVID-19 situation in the Bay Area. San Francisco Mayor London Breed and Director of Health, Dr. Grant Colfax, announced today that the city will begin its next phase of reopening on June 29th, a couple of weeks earlier than previously reported. Assuming the state approves San Francisco's request, this phase will allow hair salons, barbers, outdoor bars, and other businesses to open. Meanwhile, Governor Newsom said today that California's seen a rise in both cases and positivity rates over the last few weeks, and that the state could return to stricter shelter-in-place rules if the pandemic worsens. Joining us to make sense of this, as they've done every week for the last 3 months, are Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Erin.
Thank you for having me again.
And Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF. Welcome back to City Visions, Peter.
Always a pleasure, Pache.
All right. And I don't know if one of you has some children in the background, but I can hear some some children back there. So just wanted to do a quick sound check with you on that. All right. Well, why don't we start, Erin, with you. Let's take stock of where we are. On the one hand, San Francisco officials are pushing for a slightly accelerated reopening schedule. But on the other hand, Gavin Newsom, the governor, appears to be sounding a note of caution about the state's progress in fighting the pandemic. Which of these things should we be thinking about at this time? Should we be worried that there's a surge coming? Is this a an increase in cases that was expected with the loosening of restrictions? Tell us where we're really at.
So, I mean, I think it's complicated because it really depends on where you are in the state at this point. The truth is that San Francisco is actually looking pretty good. Their numbers have been pretty flat for a while now. Both in terms of cases, hospitalizations, like everything's looking pretty good. In fact, the hospitals are way down. So we're just seeing a lot of encouraging signs in that particular county and in a lot of the Bay Area. The state is really an entirely different story. We are seeing this increase today. The governor even, you know, hinted that if things, you know, don't get under control, that it's not impossible to put restrictions in place again. And, you know, he doesn't want to do that. Nobody wants that. But, you know, we can't kind of keep letting things spiral. And that's, we're not seeing that yet, but we're seeing definitely some concerning things if you look at the statewide numbers. But the thing with California is it's such a big state. It's so diverse. Northern California looks nothing like the Bay Area, looks nothing like Southern California. And so it kind of has to be done on this regional basis. So you're going to get these very mixed messages, and it makes it very confusing. And even across the Bay Area, you're going to see very different responses from county to county. And that's definitely what we're dealing with now. And I know that's a real struggle for the public health folks to kind of get consistent messaging across when they're kind of, I mean, there is a consistent message, which is it's all on us now, and we need to be wearing masks, and we need to be kind of maintaining our social distance, even as things reopen. So there is a consistent message, but it just gets really confusing, and it gets kind of concerning for folks who are trying to play along.
Peter Chin Hong, a lot of ink has been spilled about the fact that the whole country, the whole world was caught unprepared here, and that, in fact, we didn't realize what we needed to do until it was too late. How are we going to know that this increase in tests and cases that we're seeing is not an early signal that we should be pulling back on some of these, the lifting of some of these restrictions, or this is just kind of within the expected range of cases that come along when you start to loosen restrictions, but that we're still in the clear?
Yeah, that's a great question, Pache. I mean, I think that for sure we were woefully unprepared, and there were many botched distributions of testing and then drugs and so on. And in terms of indicators, I mean, I echo what Erin has been saying all along, which is our barometer that's most sensitive is really that contact tracing and testing in the community. And of course, that hasn't gone as smoothly as it has gone in the Bay Area as in other places. I mean, I think England and the UK were in the news because their app for contact tracing was kind of not as optimistic or didn't perform as well as people thought. And other places are not as well funded as California. So I think that's one barometer. The other barometer is really the scariest indicator is seeing the capacity of the ICU fill in slowly over time. It's kind of like the sand is filling and there's no outlet. And I think that's what's happening in Arizona and Florida right now. And speaking to one of my colleagues in Texas this morning, he was saying that he's really, really scared because the hospitals are really filling up. And also spoke to a colleague in North Carolina, Duke, same thing. I mean, they are seeing 100, 200, 300 people routinely in their hospital system. And it really is scary when you think about that aspect.
So you're saying that we're not seeing nearly those numbers here in California, especially the Bay Area?
Correct. Right now, as Erin pointed out, which I agree with, our hospitalizations have been sort of stable. I mean, I wouldn't call them zero. We still have a fair amount of people in the hospital, but surely not like what we had before, and not increasing at the same rate as we're seeing in some of the Sun Belt states.
I think to add on, if you don't mind my adding on to he's definitely right. And I think one of the key things that keeps being reinforced is by sheltering in place, we kind of bought this time to build up this huge capacity of hospital space. So even the idea is that even as we see these hospital cases increase, which we're seeing in the state, I think Gavin Newsom said today about a 13% increase over 2 weeks, that because we have this huge surge now built up that we created over the last 3 months, that puts us in a lot better. We have this cushion to kind of get things under control before we end up in a dire situation like what Peter was describing, you know, his colleagues are facing in other states.
So Peter, back to you, what would be a better way to talk about the change in the number of cases? If the number of cases themselves is not the best way to determine how we're doing, is there a different statistic that we should be monitoring that would give us an early enough signal so that we can react within a reasonable amount of time?
Totally. I mean, people have looked at different kinds of statistics. One that is relatively straightforward, and I have Erin pipe in too, because I think the Chronicle's sort of like snapshots of the Bay Area, because they do really by county look at number of tests, number of hospitalizations. And I think that's actually a good indicator. And an epidemiologist look at a statistic called the case fatality rate. So you basically look at the number of cases you have and what proportion of these people are dying. So I think that is a statistic that is sort of adjusting for the amount of testing you do. So if the case fatality rate is larger in a given county, for example, that you know that it's probably above and beyond sort of like an increase in testing. And then the R naught is something that's even more scientific, is how many people around them can one COVID infected person infect. And it's generally like 2.4 to 3 under no protection circumstances, but you get lower and lower as you put social distancing. And certainly I've been a big fan of universal masking ever since the beginning. That's probably going to be the most beneficial of all. So you can see that R naught follow, and epidemiologists can model that based on certain interventions you get. But just looking at the Chronicle's sort of like number of testing done and hospitalizations can give you a kind of a good, and mortality can give you a good sort of like measure. For example, in Oakland or Alameda County, you know, when I last looked, and Aaron can kind of adjust this observation of mine, there wasn't like a super high increase of testing, whereas there were a lot more cases. So I think that dissonance was really what made me think that Alameda and then certain parts of Marin was not that increase in cases wasn't because people were doing more testing, for example.
So as these, Aaron, as these restrictions start to lift and people are hearing that there's still an increase in cases and hospitalizations, how does any one particular person decide for themselves whether they're going to avail themselves of a looser circle of life, so to speak, in terms of engaging with others or going to shops or have engaging in services, let's say like going to a hair salon? How should people kind of put that all together to say, how should I decide what's right for me?
Well, I think that is definitely one of the most important questions right now. And it's one of those things that you kind of can't decide for any individual person. I mean, it's kind of both easy and complicated. It's easy to say, you know, if you are older, and the kind of turn to now is 65 and up, and if you have, you know, some sort of pre-existing health condition that puts you at higher risk, you shouldn't really be doing any of those things, probably. You should be staying home as much as you can for as long as you can. And after that, it's sort of, you have to take into consideration, you know, your own sort of risk judgment. And that can be thinking about who you live with, you do spend time with, and who you want to spend time with. So, you know, as a personal example, I wanted to visit my parents. And so I was, you know, determining that I wasn't going to be doing anything at all, even as things started opening up around me a little bit, I was going to remain really hunkered down because I didn't want to take extra risk, you know, before I could see them. But, you know, afterwards, I may be like, ready to take BART again. You know, I don't know, you know, when I'll feel safe to do that, but you know, that may be something that I'll think, well, I'm sort of ready to do that. Or, you know, I can learn up on it. I can think about, you know, how I protect myself. You know, I think with the masks, and we know so much now about how people can protect themselves that I think for most of us, we can make those sort of risk assessments now. And, you know, we need to start returning to doing some of these things at some point. And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be a lot safer or more problematic right now than it will be 6 months from now. We just don't know. We actually don't know what 6 months from now is going to look like. So, you know, it's hard, and people want kind of answers, but there really aren't any. And I think people just have to make those decisions for themselves. And all of us, you know, Peter included, myself included, are trying to give people kind of risk assessments for, you know, specific activity, what's more or less risky. You know, we've done that at the Chronicle. People have talked about that. But I think, you know, people are getting enough information now that they can start kind of thinking about that. How close am I going to be to another person? How much time am I going to be in the same space with that person? You know, is there a way to do that safely? If I go to get my hair cut, you know, do I go to a salon that has big wide windows that we can open up, and that I know my hairdresser won't talk to me the whole time? You know, it's like there's a lot of things you can kind of think about that may be very particular to your situation. But it's hard because it means people have to put a lot of thought into all of these interactions, which I think is just, it's exhausting, and we're all already fatigued, and that's a really hard thing for folks, myself included.
Right. It was easier when we just couldn't do anything. Now it's
exactly.
Hard. But...
Totally.
So Peter, you have a pretty good way of whittling these kinds of things down. Like what are like the 1, 2, 3 questions people should be asking themselves as they're deciding to venture out?
Well, I think one of the things that I always think about for my own self is, what is the COVID IQ of establishment X that I'm going to visit? So say it's a restaurant. Well, say it's a barbershop, because I totally need a haircut right now. You know, is that barber really taking precautions? Is the employer taking care of its workers? Do they have like the facilities? Are they taking a reservation service only, limiting the number of people that go in? When I go visit, or in congregate areas when we're waiting, is everyone wearing a mask? Those all give me confidence. And I know that barbers, for example, to take the exam, they actually have to know a lot about disinfection and cleaning surfaces. So I feel it's actually not going to be as risky. And I completely agree with Erin. I think that at some point life has to go on, and we do know enough to control our environment. I think the situations that would be on the other extreme would be places in a playground where you can't control the environment of others, or in a rock concert, or in a political convention. So I feel like in those situations, I'm not sure I'm able to control my environment. I'll be more nervous about those places.
So basically, it's a case-by-case situation. What can I do to control my situation and my circumstances to protect myself? But what is the other part of the interaction, either the group or the establishment, doing to protect me and the people around?
Yes, and the employees. And then, you know, at the end of the day, I want to echo what Aaron said, which is that we've learned a lot since this began. And in the beginning, we had this laundry list of things to do, like clean your iPhone every 10 minutes. But I think at the end of the day, where I'm settling down, and I think a lot of other people, is just really the simplicity of that mask, because people can't always do the social distance, but you wear the mask as much as you can, and you try to wash your hands and watch your distance. So the three W's, but wearing the mask is the most important.
All right. So Aaron, I wanted to build on that point of the mask. Gavin Newsom made it a statewide requirement for anyone who's going to be out of doors and not able to stay 6 feet apart from another individual. Tell us what may or may not change here in the Bay Area. We've had that expectation for quite a while, but does the governor's declaration change anything for us, for example, along the lines of enforcement?
I don't actually think it changes much for us in the Bay Area on enforcement. If it does anything in the Bay Area, it probably just reinforces a message that should already be getting out to folks. And, you know, I know that, you know, a lot of us anecdotally, you know, I mean, I personally have been fairly impressed with the mask wearing I've been seeing in the Bay Area. I feel like most places I go, people are pretty good about it. But certainly, you know, there's plenty of evidence on social media, and I hear anecdotally from others that that's not the case. And I guess, I mean, just in the Bay Area, I think the more sort of messaging we can get about the importance of this, it's just, I was actually just talking with an infectious disease expert today about the mask issue and how it's so crazy that we've gotten to this point where it's such a simple solution. It's such a small thing that can make such a big difference. And yet people really struggle with it for some reason. It's just, it's really hard for us to wrap our heads around it. And if we could just get people past that hump, right, get them used to this, make it so natural that it's like wearing a seatbelt or putting on a bike helmet, then we'd be great. We'd be in really great shape. And it's just a matter of kind of getting over that initial resistance. And I think we're actually getting there in the Bay Area. But again, you know, every time we get a message like that, every time we get that reinforcement, it helps kind of push us in that direction.
What have you heard are reasons why people in the Bay Area are not wearing masks? I know in other parts of the country, it's sort of an ideological stance that one takes, right? Depending on one's political stripe. To either wear or not wear a mask. What are you hearing about resistance here in the Bay Area? Is it similar?
No, I don't think it's similar. And Peter may have some thoughts. I'm sure he'll have some thoughts on this too. But and from what I've seen, it's honestly just sort of people not taking the risk too seriously. It's the same thing as, again, why people maybe resisted seatbelts and bike helmets, and a lot of people still don't wear bike helmets. It's like, you know what? It's not going to happen to me, and I just don't want to deal with it. And it's true, like, if I hang out, like, it's sometimes it's annoying to wear the mask. You have to, your face gets hot, or, you know, your glasses fog up, or you're hanging out with a friend and you want to drink your beer, or, you know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds of reasons why people just fuss with them and don't like them. And I think it's honestly in the Bay Area, it's a lot of that. And people thinking, I'm not that at risk. It's a lot of younger people who maybe just don't see this as being that big of a deal. And, you know, the sort of inconvenience of it wins out over the safety aspect.
And Peter, my understanding is wearing a mask is really to protect other people, right? And so that we're each doing our part to protect each other. Has something gotten lost in the messaging around this? That,
yeah, I mean, I feel like people, I mean, I agree with Aaron that it's become this behemoth of a political, ideological, and you said that too, Pache, statement. And it really puzzles me because it's such a health issue. You know, when somebody has TB and we treat them for a while, we slap a mask on them and they go on muni back home. And it's not an issue. It's not like I'm taking a side with the political statement. And, you know, there has actually been a lot of data about masks since then. And I think people just really haven't synthesized it or have been so polarized as to saying, this is my freedom, this is my body, but they're losing the whole point of wearing the mask, which is, you know, sure, it's mainly to protect others, but the more people that wear it, the more we're all going to be protected, particularly since we don't know who's infected because of asymptomatic transmission.
Well, there's lots more questions that I have for the both of you, but unfortunately, we're out of time. So I want to thank you again, both Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious diseases specialist at UCSF.
So much fun, Pache.
And you guys both get a week off next week. So we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Definitely.
Sounds good. Well, thanks,
anytime.
Guys.
Thank you.
Coming up next, how can we have productive conversations about race? We'll speak with Dr. Lori Watson, educator and racial equity consultant. Stay with us. This is City Visions. You're listening to City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. What will it take to end systemic racism? The killing of George Floyd has ignited calls to dismantle racist structures in the criminal justice system, education, healthcare, housing, employment. The list goes on. But to educator and racial equity consultant Dr. Lori Watson, part of the solution lies in teaching white people to identify the personal and sometimes unconscious racial bias that impacts their everyday interactions with people of color. Lori Watson leads seminars in the Bay Area and nationally to help individuals and organizations raise racial consciousness to achieve what she calls racial equity transformation. She's also the creator of the seminars Trust Me, Gay is Not the New Black, which focuses on the intersection of race and sexual orientation, and another entitled Black Girls Matter Too. I'd like to welcome to City Visions, Lori Watson.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And of course, we want to hear from you, our listeners. In this segment, we open our phone lines. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment on this very crucial topic that we've been spending a lot of our time on in these last few weeks, and it feels like the conversation really can go on for weeks and weeks and weeks, this is your chance to join our conversation. You can dial 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can tweet us. We're at cityvisionskalw. So Lori Watson, civil rights activist Angela Davis once said, quote, "In a racist society, it is not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist." What does it mean to be anti-racist, and why is this distinction really important?
That's a great question. You know, we're definitely hearing that term so often right now. And to me, what I believe to be anti-racist is to actively work against racism. You know, this is individual work. This is collective work to interrupt the system of racism. And when I say work against it, I'm talking about, you know, consciously, intentionally, and deliberately. Just saying I'm not racist is not enough. You know, there are many folks who believe themselves to not be racist, but are doing a pretty fantastic job of holding up the system of racism that we operate in. And there are those who believe, well, you know, I'm a good person. You know, I have a Black friend. I voted for Obama. In fact, I voted for him twice, you know, but so there's no way I can be racist. But it makes me think about, you know, the former job that I had. We talked about this wheel of racial consciousness. And so the way we described it is that there are some folks who show up as conscious. These are folks who have done their work. They're having these experiences. They're pretty well versed in race, racism, racialized experiences, all this and how it plays out. And then there are some who show up as what we describe as semi-conscious. These are folks who... I don't know. So there are some things that I need to learn. I'm going to seminars, I'm reading books, I'm watching documentaries, I'm doing whatever it is that I need to learn. And then there are some who show up as unconscious. we describe these as I don't know, I don't know. These are folks who are just completely oblivious to all the ills of racism. But then we have this group of folks who we describe as disconscious. These are folks who are, I don't know, but I think I do. And these are usually your well-meaning, well-intended folks who believe that they are not a part of the problem. And that's so often what I find in liberal Bay Area of California. You know, these folks who believe that, you know, I'm not a part of this problem. But what we have to know is that to perpetuate racism does not require intent or malice. And so good-hearted, well-meaning, you know, well-meaning people lean into racist behavior on a daily basis. And so the first thing we have to do in order to be, you know, anti-racist is to get conscious about what it is and how do I participate in it.
As a physician, I love these diagnostic criterias that you laid out, because I think it really helps to unpack what could otherwise be seen as something that's a jumble that's really hard to do, and that everyone is on a continuum of right. how alert and activated they are. So do exactly. you have a way of sort of perhaps aiming different interventions, so to speak, depending on which of those categories a white person inhabits?
Well, you know, if we really want to lean into this work, it's really about knowledge. You know, what is it that I need to learn? What are the experiences that I need to have? You know, I think about being anti-racist not as something that I do, but more about, you know, who I am. It's a way of being, you know. It's not something that you can turn on or turn off when it's convenient or inconvenient for you. It's about being able to see, you know, really the humanity in people, and especially the humanity in people who are raced differently than you are. And so what I'm talking about are folks who are willing to really put in that time to do that hard work and start to dig into their own personal beliefs about race. You know, again, we like to say that, you know, there are folks who say, I don't have a racist bone in my body, but haven't really dug into what are those unconscious beliefs that live in these dark places that we don't even know exist. You know, Ron Heifetz, who authored Leadership on the Line, says that our beliefs drive our behaviors. And so, you know, if we're not conscious to what these beliefs are, you know, then they're going to show up in our behaviors with people. And especially when it comes to something that's as sensitive, you know, as the topic of race, or when I'm caught in a racial situation, how am I going to behave? And so that work has to happen with me, again, you know, really digging into these places of understanding what this looks like for me and for those that are around me.
How do you begin that conversation with white people in your seminars to get them to go to a place that is unfamiliar, scary, and perhaps riddled with guilt or completely, you know, out of mind?
What I try to do is create a safe space, you know, and a place that's, you know, free of judgment, but this is still going to be an uncomfortable conversation, and it should be an uncomfortable conversation.
Say more about that, because I've participated in racial humility workshops, and there was a big distinction made between creating a safe space, but not creating a comfortable space.
Right, right. You know, if we're really digging into a topic such as race and really having an honest conversation, there's going to be discomfort, because we're talking about this topic that has such an ugly history for a lot of folks. And it stirs up a lot of different things for people. People show up with a variety of feelings and beliefs about this topic. And so as the conversation happens, again, there's going to be this discomfort that shows up individually, you know, collectively. But I encourage folks to really lean into that discomfort and not shy away from it. You know, the reasons we haven't been able to really progress in conversations about race is because when people get uncomfortable, they disengage. And so basically, you know, what happens is the conversation shuts down at that moment. And so talking about race is something that we have to do more often so that we can get less uncomfortable when we're talking about it. But what I'm trying to do is get people to a place of where I can get comfortable being uncomfortable. And so we have to build this racial muscle. It's almost like when I work out in the gym. You know, when I first start working out, my muscles are sore. I don't want to do it anymore because it hurts. But the more I do it, I can work through that pain and discomfort, and I can go longer, I can go harder. And just what you're naming is clarifying the difference between being uncomfortable and being unsafe. This is definitely what you're naming, what happens a lot of time, especially to my white participants. Part of privilege is that I always get to feel comfortable, which makes me feel safe. And white people are never not safe in a conversation about race, but will quickly say, I feel threatened. I feel unsafe right now. And those are two different things that we have to be clear about. And people have to realize that your discomfort does not make you unsafe. And, you know, people of color aren't unsafe. White people are uncomfortable. You can survive discomfort. And so it's about really trying to grasp that. It's about, you know, you're safe. You're just uncomfortable. And so how do I continue to build that muscle? Again, getting more comfortable being uncomfortable.
And that brings up another experience that I've heard about or experienced directly, which is when a person of color, specifically a Black person, brings up an issue, a concern of a microaggression or something worse, that there's this defensiveness, there's this sense of guilt, this paralysis that emerges from the white person, that then the conversation becomes about taking care of the white person in the room and not the Black person who brought up the concern in the first place.
Right. What you're naming is textbook white fragility. And Dr. Robin DiAngelo, whose book is flying off the shelves these days, talks explicitly about it. And basically what it is, you know, white people haven't had to learn the skills to talk about race. There are folks who can go almost a lifetime and not engage in a conversation about race. And so when a worldview that challenges, you know, that's opposite to what you've been taught all your life, you know, there are often folks who have been told not to see race, not to name race, not to you know, acknowledge that race is playing a role in anything. And so when the conversation comes up, you know, they fall into fragility, and it might show up as anger. It might show up as defensiveness. It might show up what Robin DiAngelo talks about, are white tears, the tears of white women. And so it's exactly what you named. What happens is, you know, if I was victimized to begin with and I respond emotionally because I've been hurt, I've been traumatized by a comment you made. And then when I respond, now you turn to tears. Now everyone turns all the attention to taking care of you. And so, yes, so now whiteness again becomes front and center in the conversation, and now I'm the bad guy. And so, I mean, that's how white fragility plays out, and it's definitely the intent is to shut the conversation down and restore the room to equilibrium. Because again, when we're talking about race, you know, it's not comfortable. People's emotions are running hot. But if I can shut it down, then we can go back, you know, to business as usual.
I want to give the phone number out again to this conversation. If you'd want to join this conversation with Dr. Lori Watson about white privilege, about white fragility, about implicit bias, and how to get white people unstuck in the patterns that they perpetuate, often unknowingly, that uphold racist structures in our society. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. how have you initiated conversations about race with your colleagues, your family, your friends? Tell us what went well, what didn't, what you learned from that. 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionsKALW. So I want to go back to this notion of privilege that you mentioned. In fact, your Twitter tagline is "Got Privilege," which is great. And then and then we've been hearing a lot of a rallying cry of "Check your own privilege." Talk mm-hmm. about how white people connecting, becoming aware of their privilege, is key to this this is shifting the conversation and where it goes.
Right, right. It's such an important piece of this movement that we're in the midst of right now. You know, recognizing that everyone is not having the same racial experience in this life. You know, for folks of color, we recognize race daily. I'm noticing race in through every walk of life. My life is impacted by race 100% of the time, and I'm conscious to that. But the thing is, everyone's life is impacted by race 100% of the time. But if you don't recognize that, if you're not conscious about that, that's privilege. You know, and oftentimes when the term white privilege is said, it evokes such a strong emotion and people get defensive and say, I don't have privilege. You know, I grew up poor. I struggled, you know, in this life, but it's not anything about an elevated economic means. It simply is about those unearned advantages that you accrue simply because of looking white, of being white. And so, you know, if you had challenges in your life, they weren't due to your race. Because when we talk about race, we're talking about, you know, the meanings that have been attached to race. Because as we know, race is this social construct. It's made up. There's no biology to race. But what's real about race are the meanings, the ideas, the beliefs that we have about people based on race. You know, it makes me think about Peggy McIntosh and her book, The Invisible Knapsack. And so in that, she created this exercise, the white privilege exercise, that basically, you know, is a set of questions for people to answer and think about, you know, do I have white privilege? And it helps people to be more aware of their privilege. And so, you know, it asks questions such as, you know, can I walk into a store and not be followed by someone? You know, can I go into a store and buy greeting cards with people on them that look like me? You know, me, I can go into a store and buy a greeting card with someone who looks like me, but I've got to go up and down two or three aisles and find that narrow mahogany section in order to find some cards with people that look like me. You know, it asks stuff like, can you go into any hairdresser shop and get your hair cut? I can't walk into any place. I might walk into some places and they wouldn't know what to do with me. But I mean, it's simple things like that that are a privilege. And as we even think about what's going on today, there's a privilege in being given the benefit of the doubt. You know, there's a privilege that you're less likely to be presumed guilty. You know, there's a privilege where you're less likely to be sentenced to death, more likely to be portrayed in a fair and nuanced manner. You know, privilege to when being pulled over by the police, you don't have a fear that you will come out of this situation alive. That's a privilege. You know, and I even think about Dylann Roof, the guy who shot the people in the church in Charleston. Shot and killed 9 people while they were praying in church. The police took him to Burger King after he killed all these folks. Yes, took him to Burger King. You know, and made sure that he had eaten. A Black guy can't stand on the sidewalk, you know, without being thought of as threatening. That's white privilege. And so the work is about how do I begin to recognize my privilege? And then I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with having a privilege. We have a privilege because of this racial hierarchy that's been created. But what do I do with that privilege? Because with privilege comes power. And so how do I use that in order to ensure that everyone's having, you know, a seat at the table, that their voices are being heard, that I can play a role in leveling the playing field. That's what privilege is all about. That's how you use it for good.
So I want to definitely get to that, because the idea of allyship is one that's we're seeing a lot more examples of, especially in protests. And there's a way to be an ally, and there's probably lots of ways not to be an ally. And I want to get some tips on that in a moment. But I want to go to a couple of callers first. We've got Jacqueline from Texas. Welcome, Jacqueline. You're on City Visions. Hi, Jacqueline. Are you there? All right. Let's go to Zachariah from Oakland.
Hey, greetings. I wanted to share that the work that I've done and do every day is to train myself to look at every single human being as a unique individual human being, because the most insidious thing of racism is that the world has been taught that black people are not as human as white people. That's the message of white supremacy for the last 400 years. And European colonization of Africa, that black people are not as human as white people. And we've been inculcated with that despicable mentality. And so I, as an American born and raised in the Bay Area, I have to literally train my mind to see each human being, black people, even white people, because I don't want to paint them as one thing either. And it's an extremely valuable process, and it's as the guest is saying, deliberate, intentional, conscious work. That's my comment.
Thanks so much, Zachariah, for your call and your effort. So I wanted to pick up on that, going back to the idea of implicit bias, because, you know, most people, if you told them, let's just say Bay Area here, that, you know, black people are not as human as white people, people would sort of throw up their hands and say, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And yet we know that internalized is this concept of implicit bias, that despite what we might really feel authentically, that when it comes to the day-to-day interactions, that there is so much more behind that that would betray us as not being as anti-racist or non-racist as we might mm-hmm. believe we are. Say more mm-hmm. about that.
Yeah, I mean, what you're naming is, again, just what you said. We all get conditioned in this racist society. You know, we live in a white supremacist society, and we all get these messages. I mean, exactly what Zachariah just named, you know, when people who live here, people who come here, even people who are people of color themselves, we're inundated with these messages that tell us that, you know, white is supreme, white on top. And there's definitely, you know, a conditioning that we get in anti-blackness. And so, you know, it does become, again, that how am I constantly working against these unconscious biases that show up within me, because they're going to show up. They're going to show up. Even when I do my work to be conscious and check my own personal deep-seated biases, they're still going to show up. But my work is, how do I, you know, seek them out and continue to lean in to do the work of disrupting them? You know, if I have to, you know, create a new narrative in my head, I almost have to rewire my brain, because they're so automatic. You know, and again, it's the messages we get from the time we leave home. It's happening in schools. Schools are a place of racial socialization, where kids of color are made to feel inferior and white kids are made to feel superior. You know, and I keep using the words people of color, but there's definitely a distinct and different experience for black folks. You know, and so what we have to do is really, again, get conscious about what that looks like for me. And that's the hard work, like you say, for a lot of folks. But so, it can change. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so how does that change? How, like, what is the process that someone can help do for themselves to unearth their unconscious bias and then find ways to Is it eradicate it? Is it compensate for it? What are we looking for here?
What we're looking for is, I just refer to it as having an elevated level of consciousness. We're not going to get rid of it within ourselves because it's who we are, but it's the constant interruption of it, the constant disruption of it. And if I'm more conscious about it when it shows up, you know, then it doesn't take the form, the life form that it does if I'm not conscious about it. And so how do we do it? We start doing it by, again, like I mentioned earlier, how do I really just sit in this place and think about what are my beliefs and how do I disrupt them when I notice that they're showing up in these ways that might be perpetuate racism? How do I continue to grow and learn? I got to read some new things. How do I get out of my bubble? How do I get out of my comfort zone where, you know, we live in a society right now where it's almost as segregated as it was, you know, a long time ago before folks of color could even move into certain neighborhoods. We have residential racial segregation, and it shows up in our schools. Our schools are so racially segregated now. And if I spend all my time in this bubble with people who are just like me, then I'm missing out on a counter narrative to some other racial experiences that exist around me. And so it becomes, you know, I gotta just, again, it's that whole retraining my brain, just as he mentioned earlier, how do I do that? And that becomes the hard and difficult work that a lot of people don't want to lean into.
How do people move beyond that feeling like once they do have their consciousness raised and they see their implicit bias in action, how do they move away or move through guilt that might make them feel like they could never get it right?
Right. Well, the thing we have to recognize is that as we do this work, we're going to make mistakes. There's no way we're going to do this work perfectly. Even folks who are experts at this work still, you know, continue to make mistakes. And so what I don't want is people to fall into this sense of guilt, because what guilt leads to is inaction. And sometimes it leads to anger, and it leads to anger pointed at the person who shined a spotlight on how I'm showing up. And so, you know, we have to forgive ourselves. We have to lean into some vulnerability around all of this. And it becomes, you know, if I'm showing up in a way that's creating harm or, you know, I've impacted someone in a negative way, how do I repair that? That's all it is. We're in such a place where we believe this cancel culture that we're in. Someone harms me, someone creates a problem, and then we're done. We can't connect anymore. But what we have to learn how to do is, how do we go back and repair that situation? And how do we continue to learn and grow from each other?
That's a very inclusive and compassionate stance. I imagine the fears in a lot of people's minds, whether conscious or unconscious, is that there's going to be this reckoning for white people, and that suddenly the tables are going to get turned, and so it's better to hunker down. Right. It's just an interesting the invitation that you're putting out there is so different.
Exactly. I mean, the only way we're going to eradicate or should I say continue to combat racism is it's going to take all of us together. That's the beauty in what's happening right now in this movement is it's so diverse. There's so many people coming together to stand up against against racism and how it's playing out in our country right now and across the world. But it's going to take all of us. And again, people are going to make mistakes in it. But how do I continue to stay in this place, even though I'm not sure I'm doing it right, you know, even though I'm afraid of making a mistake, but how do I commit to doing the work of anti-racism? That's what it's all about. And again, we've got to learn how to forgive ourselves. We don't know how to forgive ourselves about it.
I'm going to read
want help from everyone. Yeah.
Right. I want an email from Peter here. I have friends and colleagues of color. I'm really curious how their views to hear their views and learn from them. How do I, as a white guy, start a conversation with them without offending? I don't want to feel like the token person of color who represents all. Race is now the topic of the hour, which is great. But how does one have the conversation without narrowly defining people by their color in order to start the conversation?
Right. Thanks for that question, Peter.
And I would say here, like, how much work does one, a white person, have to do before they reach out and talk to a Black person or a person of color, and not put the onus on the Black person or person of color to, like, teach them and explain it all to them?
Right. Well, the first thing I say to people when they enter the conversation, you have to enter only from what you know. You know your own personal racial experience. You know, you can't enter into the conversation believing that you understand anyone else's racial experience, particularly someone who's raised differently than you are. But you also have to be willing to lean in and listen and learn about someone else's racial narrative, because, you know, we've got to be open to these other perspectives. And so, you know, what I find is that most of us are more alike than different, but we have to give ourselves an opportunity to find out. And we also, again, you know, have to be able to lean into this place of vulnerability. And it's what I think upsets folks, I'll speak for myself, is when it becomes, when it's not authentic. How do you show up from an authentic way? How do you not ask me, oh, tell me, what can I do to be anti-racist? Give me some tools, give me some strategies. Again, you can Google tools and strategies for anti-racism. They're all over the place. But what is it that you can do personally? And it takes practice. You know, this is just like with anything else that's new to you. You know, you have to practice it in order to get better at it. And, you know, we have to be authentic in how we really engage in the conversation about seeing race, because, you know, continuing, like I said, to show up in that place of color blindness and pretending that it doesn't matter, that's just not the reality. I mean, we're all racial beings. And if you don't see my race, then you don't see me. Yeah.
I wish we could keep going, but we have to move on. I just want to ask you one last question, which is something I asked you earlier, which is allyship. What, if someone wants to learn about what it's like, and I'm sort of breaking your rule right here by asking you this question of being an ally, how can people learn, like, what it means to be an ally? I imagine it's not hogging up the spotlight and putting yourself out there and not making yourself so self-important for doing it. But what else could someone do to be an effective ally?
Right. And, you know, I'm gonna flip it to from being an ally to being a co-conspirator. Mm. And I say co-conspiratorship because allies to me are just kind of like bystanders. You know, I'm an ally. I support you. You know, I want you to have a great experience. But an ally to me isn't really an active participant in this. You know, I want someone who, you know, I say is if we're at war, I want you down in the rabbit hole with me, you know, in the fighting side by side with me. And so what we're looking for are folks who can not only stand side to side with me, but sometimes step in there and do it for me. And so that co-conspirator is really that active person out there that again is fighting against racism just the same as we are. And it's coming from the heart. It's something, these are folks who are really anti-racist, who are internalizing the ways of being anti-racist. So that's what we're looking for.
Willing to take a risk.
Willing to take a risk, willing to have a loss, because once you step into that role, there's going to be loss for you. People who we have believed to be our friends and confidants, when you start showing up in this different way, you might lose some of those. But if you lose some of those, then maybe that's a good thing. Maybe they weren't your friends to begin with. And maybe these aren't the people that you want to surround yourself with.
Dr. Lori Watson, educator in the Bay Area on racial equity, a consultant based in Oakland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be joined now by Eugene Rodriguez. He's a musician, educator, and founder of Los Sensluttles, which is many things, a band, a nonprofit organization, a music academy, a community space for youth and families, and a hub for Latino artists. He's here with us to talk about some of his organization's recent and upcoming projects, one of which is the Front Porch Sessions. Recently, Los Sensotles, I've practiced this so many times, went around to the homes of its young music students to video them singing with their families. We were hearing a bit of that as we started the segment. Welcome, Eugene Rodriguez.
Thank you.
So tell us about the idea for the Front Porch Sessions. How did it come about?
Well, when the pandemic hit and we all had to shelter in place, I knew we had to stay in contact with our kids. We immediately jumped into Zoom and did all those lessons and all that. But we also, a lot of our students come in groups of siblings. A lot of our families, Mexican families, mostly immigrants, they'll bring the three or four, even five kids. So what we did is we started training them at home as family groups. And, but you know, there was no recital this year because of COVID-19. So I thought, you know, in those old days, folklorists used to go out to a ranch or something and record musicians on their porches and their front yards or something. And so that's what we did. We took a production crew all with masks and social distance, and we just, had them come out and greet us on their front yards, from a distance and play for us. And it was a lot of fun to see them again, even if it was from a few feet away. But it really shows the joy and the love that they have for their traditions. And we were able to share that with the world as well.
So talk about what inspired you to found this organization.
Well, Los Sensotles, I started it over 30 years ago. I'm Mexican-American, third generation. And for me, it's about connecting with my grandparents, with my uncles and aunts. And in the course of my work, started in the 80s, the immigrant boom happened, the immigrant boom that changed our country in the 90s. And so the meaning of our work shifted throughout the years, but it was always something very important. When I started, most of the kids were Mexican-American, English-speaking, and then increasingly the kids became immigrant children, primarily Spanish-speaking. And now we've gone full circle where we have the children of the immigrants who are our students now. So the tradition is the long tether. It's the thing that keeps us all, connected to through time and even through space, since we're talking about immigrants from Mexico. So the work to me is about connecting, connecting to each other, connecting to ourselves.
And so in this time of pandemic, you reached out and created the Front Porch Sessions.
Right.
How has the recent attention for racial justice resonated with you and the people of Los Sensotles?
Well, a lot of our students are younger folks, and some are college students, some are just teenagers in high school still. And they've all taken this on in a very, very sincere and a very passionate way, the need to advocate for Black Lives Matter. They feel very strongly about that. And we feel very strongly that allies are very important to stand side by side. And we have always felt that way. Our work has connected to various ethnicities and races. We've done an African-American project with Taj Mahal, a Creole Zydeco Mexican project with a Richmond-based Zydeco musician. We did an Irish-Mexican record with the Chieftains and Ry Cooder. So this is something that we've always felt very strongly about. Preservation Hall, we did an amazing project with them as well, connecting the Mexican roots of jazz side by side with the African-American roots of jazz. So it's something that we feel very strongly about. And when we stand side by side, we just become stronger.
Well, as we wrap up, we're going to hear a bit from the collaboration of Los Sensotles musicians with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band in New Orleans. And I'm sorry we had to cut it shorter than I had wanted, but I want to thank you, Eugene Rodriguez, for the work that you do and for coming on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Aaron Alday of The Chronicle, Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF, Lori Rotson, racial equity consultant, and Eugene Rodriguez, founder of Los Sensotles. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. Our engineer this evening was Davian Miner, and our show is produced by Susie Britton and Jillian Emblad. We'll be off next week and back on July 6th. Good night. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Nada me importa cuando me besas de todo.